Together we all take a very deep breath. We see in the middle of our mind a little ball of golden light. We watch this light as it begins to grow larger and larger, until now it covers the entire inner vision of our mind. We see for ourselves within this light a beautiful temple. We see a garden that surrounds the temple and a body of water that flows through the garden. We see that the inside of the temple is lit by this same beautiful golden light. And we're here, for we have been drawn together by the power and in the presence of God. We devote our time spent together and all of our relationships to one another, to Him. We ask that His Holy Spirit, which is within us, so guide our thoughts, our feelings, our perceptions of all things, that we might grow to become happier and more peaceful and more loving human beings. Thank you very much. Together, we all say, Amen. What I'd like to talk to you about tonight is the fact that the Course in Miracles tells us that happiness is a decision that we make. There's an exercise in the Course that says, heaven is a decision that I must make. Usually we think in terms of figuring out what would make us happy, and we go for those things. We try to make this happen or that happen because we think that if those things happened, we would be happy. But psychologically what's going on there is that the core belief is that I'm not happy. I'm not happy because that's why, and because I'm not happy, I need this, 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 and this. So the problem about going after those things that we think would make us happy is that they are compensating for a lack that we perceive. And so the core belief is still lack. The core belief is still I'm not happy. So the subconscious will continue to recreate conditions that we will interpret unhappily. So even if we get what it is we thought would make us happy, we're still not going to be happy. And many of us have experienced that. In fact, the Course in Miracles says all of us have. That at some point or another, we got that thing that we thought would make us happy, and we still weren't happy. We could go, if we had a computer, and we could look into the lives of every person here, and we could just register what's going on in your life today. And we took every single person, and then we took a vote and of what was going on in lives. And then we also measured every single person, and somebody went up to you and said, on a scale of 1 to 10, how happy are you? What's interesting is how unrelated the circumstances might be to who was happy and who wasn't. Because a lot of times we say, I'll be happy when this or that has happened. But the interesting thing that you find out about the happy people when you look at them, they're like species. I like call my happy friends up sometimes. I like, can I just like hang out today? And one of the things I notice about people that I know who have that muscle together, and it is an emotional muscle, it's a discipline that it takes. This idea of really cultivating the ability to be happy does not mean, you know, sometimes I'll say to myself, I can't wait for the day when nothing is going on to make me unhappy. But that's not what life is unless you go live elsewhere. I have no idea where. But if you have any life that's going on, that's got any kind of dynamic movement to it or growth to it, and particularly growth to it, because growth works in the way that, you know, the top of one mountain is the bottom of the next. Never seems like you really get to rest on your laurels, do you? You know, you think you have it together in some area, and you're just really sailing, and the universe says, ooh, you're good. Can you take that? You know, you just always, there's always something new. So there's always something going on that if you wanted to interpret in such a way that you would feel crushed, you could. So the growth to happiness does not mean that more happy things happen, but that you, so much. I mean, obviously, it's easier to be happy when things are going well. But still, the muscle that the Course in Miracles says we're responsible for is one in which our minds develop the capacity to concentrate on the things that can make us happy today and to hold the things which could make us miserable on any given day in a category which says does not matter at the moment. Because what I've certainly watched my mind do, and I'm sure yours does too, because we're all the same, is if there are 15 things that could make me happy on any given day, and then something to make me miserable, I'll find something to make me miserable. My latest thing is I called my friend Richard and I said, oh, I think I have brain cancer. Now, I have a lot of weaknesses and faults, but I'm not a hypochondriac. That's not usually one of my things. Although, if your sister, I've mentioned to you that my sister is seriously ill, and that has been seriously ill, and it does something to your ego. Takes more of a more fertile ground now that my sister has gotten cancer. it's different. But still, that's not my thing to be a hypochondriac. So I called Richard. I said, and I had all these reasons for why I have brain cancer. So my friend grabbed the phone and said, she doesn't have brain cancer. I said, sort of beating on him, how do you know I don't have brain cancer? And he said, because you had a happy day yesterday. That's why you think you have brain cancer. There's nothing else you could look to. Because, and he pointed out on every given day, and finally I had said yesterday, oh, it was a perfect day except for my fight with my friend Steve, let's say. Well, Steve came up to me at a party last night, and we made up. So guess what happened this morning? I had brain cancer. And when he pointed that out to me, it was so obvious that that's exactly what had happened. Because as soon as there was nothing to look to say, you know, this is wonderful, this is wonderful. My sister-in-law, my ex-sister-in-law, used to not get along at all with my mother. And the story that my sister-in-law used to tell about my mother was true. And that is that one day, one day my ex-sister-in-law had spent the whole day, she had bought a store, children's books, and she was painting the store all day. She was remodeling and doing all, you know, to fix up the place. So late in the afternoon, my mother came to visit to see it. And so my ex-sister-in-law said, well, Mom, what do you think? Isn't it great? And my mother said, Ivy, that corner over there, I don't think you finished that corner over there. Right? So this drove my ex-sister-in-law crazy. I didn't even realize how sick it was because I had grown up around it. But the most potent realization for me was that I had developed that. Whether, as we say here all the time, it really is irrelevant where you got it. The point is that you do it. In other words, there are so many things you could say. The shelves are fabulous. I love the coat of, I love that color that you chose. The floors look good. There are so many wonderful things that you could say, but the mind went right over to one thing that wasn't so good, and that was what the mind focused on. We all do that in our lives to some extent, and when you look at it, maybe not all of us, excuse me if you don't, but if but if we look closely at what that's about from A Course in Miracles perspective, there's a very, very heavy-duty, hardcore ego thought, which is behind all this. And that is that the ego is our self-loathing. The ego is our self-hatred. The ego is the resistance that we have within us to being happy. And to see the various forms that it takes is very fascinating, because what we recognize is that while we might spend all of our lives going around thinking, God, I try so hard to make things right. I try so hard to make things go well in my life. What we really ultimately have to deal with is the fact that we have made a decision that we're not going to be happy. Or at the very least, probably even more so, we have made a decision not to be happy. There is almost a cultural bias against it. So let's look at that. Let's look at some of the forms that that takes. First of all, when I was growing up, our generation, you know, I remember we used to walk around college and high school and you'd have like Russian poetry on your, you know, under your arm. You read it and you frowned. You cultivated a kind of artistic, creative frown because this indicated to the world that you understood suffering. You understood the human condition. Now, the truth of the matter is your frown indicates that you realize nothing about the human condition, because the highest realization about the human condition is that we are at choice. But that's a very mature understanding. So this, we got into this thing about how suffering, first of all, suffering is better. Now, Carl Jung talked about how suffering brings consciousness. Interestingly enough, suffering does bring consciousness. Many of us here, all of us actually have suffered in our own way. And most of us, if not all of us, have seen how there have been periods of our life where we can say that I grew from that suffering. But what needs to be considered from A Course perspective is that joy is also an extremely transformative experience. Bliss is a more transformative experience than pain. The issue is we know so little about it. So we know that pain brings transformation because we've been there. We don't know anything about the transformation brought on by bliss because we have had so little of it. Now, if you've ever read a book called Movable Feast by Hemingway, Hemingway wrote about all the great artists that were around Paris at the turn of the century, and that whole period of great painters and great authors, and Fitzgerald and Picasso and Matisse and stuff like that. And Picasso, you know, he was one of the artists that set the tone for the suffering I suffer, therefore I'm great stuff. And just in the last few years, interestingly enough, with the later biographies coming out about Picasso, we see that his art, when he started really suffering, his art did not get better. That actually is art. But one of the things that was always so fascinating to me was an artist, one of my favorite artists from that time, is Matisse. But in the dialogue and in the writings and all that personal stuff in the journals and the books by people like Hemingway about those artists at that time, one of the really interesting things was that Matisse stood out because he was happy. And even though the whole sort of zeitgeist of that time, you know, pre-World War and all the stuff going on in the world was this honoring of suffering, this philosophical, aesthetic honoring of suffering, that my art comes from my suffering, Matisse was just standing there saying, I'm happy. Right? And he could, I don't know why you guys are so, and Picasso, you say, ah, Matisse, he's always smiling. Right? But the truth of the matter is Matisse's art has certainly stood up with time. As a matter of fact, Matisse is one of the great resurrection stories. The life of Matisse is one of the great stories of how we hold to resurrection in spite of crucifixion. It's a little bit of a digression, but I want to tell you this Matisse story if you haven't heard it before. When Matisse got very old, he got arthritis so badly in his hands that he could no longer hold a paintbrush. Now, imagine. Just like Beethoven not being able to hear. Imagine if you were, and you are, on whatever level you are, great. But imagine if that vehicle that you think of as the place where you give your gift and experience your gift and experience the joy and the satisfaction that giving gives to you and others. Imagine if that vehicle were denied you. So imagine being a great painter and no longer being able to hold a paintbrush. Now, this is exactly what we're talking about. We're talking about whether or not joy is circumstance dependent. Now, a lot of, in a way, lesser personalities would have just been completely destroyed by that. What Matisse found out was that even though he could not hold a paintbrush, he could hold those little scissors like elementary school children use. And so even though he couldn't paint anymore, he could, using those scissors, cut out colored paper. And you've all seen Matisse's paper cutouts because they turned out to be one of the very greatest periods in his art. We've all seen the pictures of Matisse's color paper cutouts, which were done because he could no longer hold a paintbrush. So he held, the whole idea here is that if we have a space internally that we hold to, that circumstances will come around to uphold the space, the internal space that we have committed to. The ego has it the opposite. The ego says, I will be in that emotional space when I get what I want. I'd be happy if I could hold a paintbrush. But Matisse wasn't going to say he was going to be happy if he could hold a paintbrush. But how interesting that he's someone who was famous for years for going around demonstrating to everyone around him that he had a commitment to happiness. And obviously his commitment to happiness, I mean, does that mean that Picasso had things to suffer about and Matisse didn't have things to suffer about? That's the whole point here. No, Matisse's life was probably very similar in a lot of ways to Picasso's life. But there was, for whatever reason, a commitment on his part to be happy anyway. I remember a friend saying to me once in my life many years ago, he said, you know, Marianne, it's more difficult to smile. Because, you know, I cultivated that frown. You know, I understood the human condition, right? To recognize that that's true. The work that it takes to be happy. See, we brought another thing we had, because a lot of us grew up in the 50s and stuff, we thought any smile was a fake smile. So that we really did develop, you know, you used to hear people, and sometimes you still do, I don't want to go to therapy, I don't want to get sober, because my creativity is tied up with my dark side. Right? My angst feeds my creativity. Now, let's look at that, because even though we laugh about it, part of the laughter is nervous laughter, because we do have, you know, the Course in Miracles says, beware the danger of an uninvestigated belief. of a hidden belief. These reasons that we have, all of us, that we just don't think it would be quite right to be happy. And why, when we say it's not quite right to be happy, same thing as saying for whatever reason we have a resistance to letting ourselves have joy in whatever form that it might appear. And these hidden beliefs, one of them, once again, this business that somehow our creativity is tied to our dark side. Well, let's talk about that, how that works, especially creative people. Artists say that all the time. But one of the things, as we've discussed here before, a person who is a creative artist, such as a painter or a writer or a musician, is really, everybody's life is the creative life. So when you read the laws of aesthetics, and if you read about great artists and the lives of great artists, they apply to all of us. You might not be a singer, you might not be a writer, but the creative life, as they say in the occult tradition, there is no higher art than living our lives. As a matter of fact, our whole characters, our personalities are like a character, aren't they? That we're always inventing, that we're always drawing for ourselves. Your life is a movie, and you are the producer, and you are the director, and you are the star. Interestingly enough, if you take a script and you give the same script to two actors, this is a perfect demonstration of how the way we play life has very little to do with what happens in the script that we're given. Because you otherwise it wouldn't matter who played the part. You can have a great screenplay or a great play, but it's going to make a lot of difference who plays the part. Because the actor is going to make decisions about how those same lines are read. Different actors are going to make decision how that same script is played out. One actor will decide to scream that line. Another actor is going to decide to say that line following a long silence. And then when they speak, it will be practically whisper. And that decision, it will be the same line, but the decision that the actor makes will make all the difference in the world. Same with our lives. So we're all creating all the time. And so it's not the script that we're given, but what we decide to do with it. Now, this business about the creative life and how much we need our darkness, our angst, to be part of the creativity that we're into, we've all suffered. Unless you're, I mean, I'm 38 years old, I've known a lot of people, and I've lived a lot of life myself, as we all have. I don't know anybody who hasn't. So we've all seen darkness. I don't know about you. I don't think I need to experience anymore. I have enough to draw on. I have enough memories to draw on. Okay. And this is a big place to get to in your life. To have a commitment to that. I've suffered enough. Thank you. You know, like you gotta know the suffering of people. You know the suffering of people, right? You really don't need to see the 6 o'clock news anymore. You got it, right? Because it is the same old stuff over and over again. Now let's talk about that relation to being on the earth and being a creative person. Well, if you look at a great movie, or you look at a great novel, or you look at a great piece of art, often they include darkness, but in a way that exorcises it and leads us beyond it to the light. Take a movie like The Mission. Take a movie like Dances with Wolves. They show us the darkness, but they also point beyond the darkness, which always has to do with the direction of resurrection, which always has to do with the direction of the human capacity to do it differently. Which is all that the resurrection is. Resurrection is the power of God demonstrated on this earth through human beings who choose to demonstrate it. Now, a movie, a book, whatever, that only shows us the darkness, but doesn't give any indication of resurrection at the end, that's not art. That's bad art, and it's bad theology too. And much Christianity is like that, where the ego has so concentrated on the crucifixion, it never gets around to the real point of it, which is the resurrection. So it's interesting because a lot of people who would say, I'm very liberal in my religious beliefs, and I'm not into all this guilt and suffering crucifixion business, very much are in their own lives. Because when we choose suffering, when we choose in our own lives to rest on that which is dark, this means that we are choosing crucifixion in our own lives. I know for myself, my most creative periods and the things that have come out of me have not been when I was suffering. They've been when I was no longer suffering, but I could remember the suffering, right? Because the truth of the matter is, when you're suffering, God can't use you as much. You're too depressed. A happy person has more energy. And so does a person who's not worrying about the bills all the time. So is a person who's not worrying about all the stuff that we worry about. And you really do get to see that the reason the ego mind is always constructing circumstances. The subconscious is always in conspiracy with the ego. There's always something to make us miserable about. And like we were already discussing, it's not even so much that things are made to make us miserable. The mind goes into something. It either manufactures something we can be miserable about or puts everything together in such a way that we can justify the reason for our misery. And the reason we do that is because the ego does everything in its power to make sure that we are not men and women who give ourselves permission to shine. Because when we give ourselves permission to shine, that means we're clear. I'm here. I'm not here. You know, when I was in high school, I had a drama teacher who really, and there's so many people, I can't tell you how many people, all over the country. This man retired last year, and people flew in from all over the country who he had taught, like in high school, what he taught us about life. And all these people who had been his acting students, and some of whom were very big Hollywood stars. It was amazing. All these people who claim that he taught them everything that they needed to know about acting and acting careers. But there were many of us there who were not actors. He taught us everything you need to know about life. He certainly taught you everything that you need to know about showing up for any kind of professional situation. And I remember the things he used to say. First of all, it was something, you know, but when you're at that kind of an age, these things matter to you so much. He used to always say to us, he used to teach us about leaving your problems at the stage door. And this generation is very undisciplined that way. And that's such an important concept for any kind of work. It's not just for theatrical work, it's for any kind of work, that you have some discipline that lacks the self-indulgence. See, we're a very self-indulgent generation, and we let our stuff spew over everything. Right? It's like we take the fact that we're depressed, and it keeps you in bed all day. You know, and I know I've been lecturing for a long time. And sometimes people would say to me, God, Marianne, how do you do it? You know, if you're going through something that you're depressed about, how do you do it? You know, and there would be times, there have been times in my life when I'd be so depressed over something going on, how am I going to get up and give a lecture? But I had to. I had no choice. But I've seen how the mind operates. I had to get up. I had to get dressed. I had to go to work. I had to give the lecture. And the mind knew that. It just knew it. My problems were going to be left at the stage door, period. And I've watched how my mind worked, because while I was at the lecture, I was fine. I'd go home as soon as I hit the driveway. I just can't believe it. So it's obvious that this stuff is invented. It's so obvious that there was this period of time, this context I created for myself, in which I was given permission by myself to rise above it. And the other thing that Mr. Pickett used to tell us was about how, he says, even if you have one person in the audience, you play it full, you play 100%. No matter how many people are in the audience. If you ever remember when I was younger and I used to go hear singers, and used to get the feeling if you were only like one of two people in the audience, if the singer would come out on the stage and look, and it's just you, and so you wouldn't get much of a performance, and you'd be thinking, well, you know, I paid as much as if I would have paid if this audience was full of people, and they were going to give less. Well, the less you give to life, the less life is going to give to you, right? So all this business about hearing this from Mr. Pickett and leaving your problems at the stage door, what you begin to realize is how self-indulgent we are with our misery. We indulge our misery. And the whole issue of indulging our misery, you know, the Course in Miracles says, look at the crucifixion, but do not dwell on it. And the ego mind wants us to think that there's this power in indulging the misery. There's a power in indulging the misery because, as we said already, it's part of our creative process or whatever. And what we want to, I remember once at an AIDS group, one of the men who was sick or who was dealing with illness in his life anyway, said to me, and hearing me talk, he said, I feel like you're invalidating my pain. Talking like I'm talking now, basically. And I said to him, I'm not invalidating your pain, but I am validating your capacity to move beyond it. I remember once I was going through something in my life, and I was with some friends, and it was like this talk about when was I going to get over something that I was going through. And I remember my friend Jim saying, well, I think she'll get over it when she wants to get over it. And when he said that, there was like a light bulb in my head. It was like a brick to my forehead, because I knew on some very deep level that he was right. as long as we believe in finite resources, we can't allow ourselves to be fully happy. Because you see, the way of finite resources, the way of the ego is, if some people are rich, other people are going to be poor. If some people are going to be successful, some people aren't going to be successful. And you take that down the road, you just end everything in life, you're afraid to show up shining and happy. There's this picture of my baby over there, if you haven't seen the picture of my baby. Now, my baby is adorable. I'm not saying she's more adorable than other babies. Babies are adorable. But one of the things you'll notice about her smile, the only word I can think for it is unabashed. You can't smile like that if it has ever occurred to you that you might not be beautiful. She couldn't smile like that if it has occurred to her that she might not be okay. And she can't smile at other people like that if it has ever occurred to her that you might not be okay. There's just no room, she hasn't picked it up yet, that it's not okay to smile like that. So the smile is just, but you know, she, not only does she smile that way, she's also given permission to smile that way. Many of you might remember, I don't know if you were in the room, do you remember once, in fact, you're here, because I saw you a few minutes ago, Bettina, yeah. I saw you here. Remember the night you sang? Bettina was coming up to sing. And before she sang, there was a little girl, like a four-year-old or something, who came up and sang a very beautiful song. And she was so adorable. Everybody, yay! Right? And then Bettina came up. I don't know how old you are. You're a young woman. And Bettina's very beautiful. And she also sang a very beautiful song. Now, people applauded Bettina. The interesting thing to see was that this child, in her beauty and her magnificence, does not threaten anybody with her beauty and her magnificence. A woman in her 20s or 30s, extremely attractive, comes up and sings a beautiful song. The men have to go through what they have to go through, and the women have to go through what they have to go through. Right? Now, to God, it's two innocent children of God came up and gave their beauty. And I also know what anybody gets up and gives their gifts has to go through in terms of the permission you have to give yourself. But part of the problem we have giving permission to ourselves is the fact that we know that other egos also have problem giving us permission. So if you really, if you really want to be popular, you don't shine too much. If you really want to be popular, you're never completely happy. Right? If you really want to be popular, you always keep everything just a little tint of misery so other people can relate to you. Right? And that's the conspiracy that we have going on. And that's why we do as adults what we did as children. We're always witnessing. I'm always looking at people who seem to have some area together. And when I see the people that I have this one girlfriend, and I admire her very much for what I think of as her emotional musculature, and I watch her in relationships. She loves deeply. It's not like she's an insensitive person, and she goes through very deep and passionate situations in her life. But I've also noticed her, that when something is down or something is over or whatever it is, she has a capacity to let stuff roll off her back that I admire. And it's not like I can say, well, I know she gets over it easily, but, she never felt deeply either. What I had to be confronted with in witnessing her was she felt very deeply. And at a certain point, she had a capacity, if there was no way that this suffering she was into was going to serve her, she had a way to lift above it. And that way to lift above it is, in Course in Miracles terms, the cornerstone of the Course, which is nothing real can be threatened and nothing unreal exists. Herein lies the peace of God. The Course in Miracles says our reality is joy, our reality is happiness. Your reality is that you're powerful, your reality is that you're strong, your reality is that you're unique, your reality is that you're perfect. Now, right there, even in saying that, I know that when I say you are completely innocent, you're completely perfect, you're completely as God created you, each and every one of us, the Course in Miracles says that anything you've achieved is a fraction of what you're capable of. There's nothing that any mistakes that we've made, that any of us have made, that in any way changes or modifies our essential truth, which is how perfect we are. And that's just the way it is. Like Terry Cole Whitaker, I once heard Terry Cole Whitaker say, you're perfect because God doesn't create junk. This is not to your personal credit. It's not like I'm perfect. Our personal self is not perfect. It's not the small I, the self with a small s, but the self with a capital S that the Course in Miracles describes as the real self, the Christ self, the power that is in us but not of us, just happens to be perfect. And we are on this earth to show it. And whereas the ego shows finite resources, that if one person wins, another person's going to lose, which makes us also then get into competition, because God forbid another person win, because if they win, somebody else isn't going to. I actually found, I've told the story before, I was living with a girl who was a teenager, and I walked into her bedroom one day, and there were several teenage girls around a bed looking at a poster, a centerfold picture of Christie Brinkley. And this is what they were saying, things like, you know, she's not really perfect. And they were finding ways that she, which is hard to do, that Christie Brinkley wasn't quite that perfect, you know? Or then the one that not only men do to women, but women do to women, which is, well, even if she is that pretty, I bet she's not that smart. Right? Right? We keep women in their place with that one, don't we? So they were trying to find ways that Christie Brinkley could be seen as not so fabulous. Because the ego mind was telling them that if she was fabulous, they were less. Not realizing that she's fabulous. Glory, hallelujah, she's so fabulous. And I told these girls, really what was going on was they all want to be gorgeous, which they all can be. In their own way, they all can be. And the way to be gorgeous is that when you see a picture of Christie Brinkley, say, glory, hallelujah, bless that child and bless the Lord who made her. Right? But that's how, as we, what, because whatever we bless in another person, that's a way of saying, I like that, I'll take one. Right? But whatever you put down in another person, that's your way of saying, I don't allow that in people. So if you don't allow them to win, then when your wins start coming up, you won't allow yourself a win either. Right? So the Holy Spirit, just like Buckminster Fuller, proved that everybody on this earth could live like a billionaire. We have the technological resources right now that everyone could live like a king. But we don't have the thought which says everyone can win. And that's just a thought that we have. Like if I hear one more actress say, there just aren't any good roles for women. Oh, let's all agree on that, okay? See, these are just thoughts that we have. And we state them over and over again. Whereas, as we were saying before, the whole power of the mind is that we are committed to a context. We are committed to a context. And then the world around us rises to meet us. Just like Matisse. You know, whenever we have these, you know, this kind of, the Course in Miracles says we are not a victim of the world. So whatever time, you know, I think one of the gifts, if you can call it a gift, that AIDS has been in this community for many people is that we are a generation who in many ways really never knew what suffering was. Many of us anyway, certain socioeconomic backgrounds. So we, you know, I remember that story when my mother came home when I was a little girl, my dad came home, and I was crying. And my father said to my mother, what's wrong? Why is she, you know, I was just howling. And my mother said, she wants to be a poor black child. And she just, and my father said, what do you mean she wants to be a poor black child? And I was screaming, crying, I wanted to be a poor black child. And where I got this, if I was poor and we were black and we lived in a ghetto, I would grow up, I'd be artistic. I will never sing the blues, I used to say. I will never understand the blues. It's impossible. We have too much money and we're white. I will never be able to sing the blues. Now, you know what the interesting thing is? Okay, we laugh. We laugh. But you know what's behind that? I got that thought that unless I suffered, I'd never be creative. And you know what? It's not cute. Because you know what a lot of us did? The subconscious mind said, oh, okay, we'll find some for you. Isn't that exactly right? Because if you have the thought which says, I'll never be a deep person unless I've suffered, white people can figure out ways to make it happen, right? You don't have to have any external circumstances. You know, torture is torture. And so it wasn't so cute because I did grow up, as a lot of people did, with this notion that unless I've suffered, I'll never really, you know anything. And, you know, it's better if I've suffered. You know, it's like when you think, boy, if I'm poor, I'll have camaraderie with the poor. Well, that's so ridiculous. The poor don't need your camaraderie. They could use your cash. I mean, what's the kinder thing to, you know, it's like, hey, I just did the Angel of Revolutionary handshake. Hey, man, you got my camaraderie. Great. Right? A donation? No, I'm sorry, I don't have any. I can't do anything to help you, but man, my soul feels what you're going through. Oh, great. Right? So a lot of us have these little hidden ways in which we think playing small is better for people who are small, or playing small, for whatever reason, will make other people appreciate us more, or whatever it is, the little prejudice that we have against having the courage to say, you know what, I'm going to be happy today, because it would be better for the planet if I was happy. It would be better for me if I was happy. I've had enough of the other stuff. Will I continue to go through the pain of being a human being? I'm sure in many ways. Of course we will continue to go through the pain of being human beings. But there is a way that the mind can use our pain. There's a way that the mind can use it in an emotion. You know, there's a double-edged sword to being a really sensitive person. It's a double-edged sword being a really emotional person. And I've known this in my own life, as many of us have. My deep emotions about things, in fact, I feel things deeply, have certainly fueled some of the best I've been capable of. But my deep feelings about things have also fueled some of my most neurotic moments and some of my most wasted years. Right? And so really holding our lives in such a way that we make a commitment to being happy. We make a commitment to being in a place, like I said, those people that I've witnessed, and when I'm in that place, what I see happens is not that things don't happen. It's that there is a way in which certain things do not get my attention. And a life of faith enables that to happen. Because if it's not love, it's simply something in process. If your relationship is breaking up, if you're heartbroken, that's why we're here. That's why we study all this kind of stuff. If it's not of truth, if it's not of joy, if it's not of love, if it's not of perfection, it's temporary. It's temporary. God's on the case. To concentrate on the darkness only keeps the darkness in place for a longer period of time. The Course in Miracles is, as the Bible says, blessed are those who have faith who cannot see. Sometimes a pilot has to fly on instruments. He knows the ground is down there. The visibility is very poor. He cannot see the ground. And in that moment, he has to fly on instruments. Sometimes we're sad. Sometimes someone's sick. Sometimes someone has died. Sometimes people are in conflict. Sometimes people have argued. Sometimes we don't have a job. Sometimes we don't have any money. Those are the times we have to fly on instruments. We have to have faith. Blessed are those who have faith who cannot see. Times we have to say, God, I can't really see why I should be happy. But I at least intellectually know that that doesn't mean that there's not a reason to be happy. The reason to be happy is that this is simply a situation in process. That's all that it is. And the miracle here is a shift in my mind from my agreement with the tragedy to instead my agreement with the Holy Spirit within me that no matter what the conflict, it will be resolved. This person loves me even if they don't know they love me. I love them even though I might not feel at the moment like I do. This sickness is merely an aberration and there is love and healing behind it. And the greatest service that I can do to myself and to the world around me is to invoke the light in the midst of darkness. In the Jewish Book of Wisdom, which is called the Talmud, it is asked, what is the Jew to do in the time of the greatest darkness? And what the Talmud says to the Jew is, during the time of the greatest darkness, act as if the light had already come. You have a commitment to light. You have a commitment to happiness. And this invokes it. And one of the ways it invokes it in conclusion is this. We all know this from our friends. Let's say you have a really miserable friend. And let's say that friend is really like so depressed. And will you call me when you get home because I'm so depressed. And do you think you could come over? Once is fine. It's what it means to be a friend. Twice what it means to be a friend. But after a few times, you just feel this person is sucking at your energy. Now, what about your friends who you know are going through this? But they have something in them. They're not lying about what they're going through. They're not in denial about what they're going through. But their energy, you feel the energy of a person willing to go through it. Willing to work through it. You want to help. Isn't that right? Because you're not picking up from them a commitment to the tragedy. You're picking up from them, yeah, I'm going through it, but I'm willing not to be. I got to tell you something. I've worked with a lot of people who have AIDS. And I know people who have AIDS who bitch less than some people these days because mommy didn't give me piano lessons. And that's the truth. Because these days, there's so much in the air that has to do with finding what I can be miserable about. And then when you see people who are truly dealing with things that bring real perspective in your life when you're around it, because you see things that really could cause heartbreak, but you see these people struggling and using every emotional muscle that they have available to them to keep them up because they know that their very lives depend upon it. You are humbled sometimes in the presence of these people. Louise Hay, we have so much to be grateful to Louise Hay for. She has done, people have no idea what that woman has done. Because as soon as AIDS came on the scene, Louise Hay, in such a powerful way, put it out there, no self-pity. She gave to a whole, she just created such a context around AIDS, which is, that will not help us to sink into this. Let's rise above it. And incredible things happen, things which affect the psychoimmunological factor. They have now proven that people who have been diagnosed with terminal illnesses live twice as long when they attend support groups. Support groups, real support groups, are not where you are supported in seeing how terrible this is. Real support groups are when we are supported to see how no matter what the disease, no matter what the condition, no matter what the circumstance is in our lives, nothing outside of us can diminish our capacity to give love. Nothing outside of us can diminish our capacity to receive love. Sometimes it's those situations in our lives which are the most painful, which are the greatest opportunities for us to learn what it means to expand our hearts. And ultimately, the only real joy in life is to be a person with an expanded heart. That's the only thing ultimately which enables us to have joy. The only way we can really be happy, the Course in Miracles says, is not when things go the way we want them to go. The only way to really be happy, the Course in Miracles says, is when we become people for whom it doesn't really matter how things go today, because we have decided to be happy. Thank you very much. Amen.